What's up and welcome to Mostly Film, your one-stop chaotic shop for all things in the world of cinema. I'm one of your hosts, Jonathan Recorder, joined by my beautiful co-host, JP Patton.
Hey, what's up?
Not much. And Luna, you want to say something? Because you got a lot to say right now.
Yeah, she's acting real fussy.
She's a little whiny Yorkie today. Listen, at work the other day.
Yeah.
My owners, they've been talking about, everybody's, oh, they bring their dogs in all the time. Have you ever seen the Happy Z's commercials?
Nope.
Actually, no, that's wrong. I saw the first one. I think it was the Super Bowl. Maybe. Not it was like a Super Bowl commercial they had. And yes.
Anyway, they have a big golden doodle.
Yeah.
TJ. They have a Aussie mini Australian Shepherd and a little Scotty doodle.
Oh, so they like stupid dogs.
Oh, yeah. They're great.
Any doodle.
Oh, they're all so cute. So awesome.
But end up being like absolute stupid.
I don't know. I'm a fan of these dogs, and okay. I finally got to meet them all in the same day.
Well, my sister has a golden doodle, and I think it's probably the stupidest dog I've ever seen.
Luna, that's good for you.
Yeah.
I thought that would be you.
Nothing to say. Oh,
she licked, just licked right on the mic.
Yeah.
So now she's upset. She didn't like that. She was,
didn't like it.
Anyway, hey, listen.
Yeah.
It's Robin Williams Day. Week two. Two new films.
Yeah.
Insomnia, What Dreams May Come. And I had a great time with both of these films.
Your phone's transcribing everything.
Hey, listen, it's Robin Williams Day. Week two, new films, Insomnia, What Dreams May Come. And I had a great time with both of these films. That's pretty good. It picked up all that.
I was rereading
it. So I'm not having a stroke. I was reading what it said. So let's just jump right into it, man. So before we like break down our ratings, last week we did The Birdcage and we did Moscow and the Hudson.
Yes.
And this week was Insomnia and What Dreams May Come. Which week won? Before we break down the ratings, I'm curious to what week won, because we'll talk about why.
What week won?
Yeah. Which week wins? Week one or week two?
Probably, I think I enjoyed the performances more week one.
Okay. You're entitled to your wrong opinions.
Well, I think it was more evenly distributed.
Yeah.
I would say this week, one movie is way better performed than another.
So is it fair to say that one of the films this week is your favorite of the series so far? Or no?
Yeah, probably.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, which one do you want to talk about first?
Let's talk about Insomnia, because
I have hives, by the way.
Yeah.
Itchy. I'm itching so bad.
Is it hot when you stuff when you need the fan?
No, it's not like that. I can feel I got like eight whelps on my back and like eight on my head, and I'm about to like die.
Okay.
Well, I'm gonna pop like eight Benadryl tonight.
Dude, that's gonna be some of the best sleep.
I hate those sleeps, man. Like that NyQuil, I got one popping up in my eyebrow too. That so it's not something downstairs. I don't know, man. Maybe it's AIDS. I'm riddled with it.
Riddled with AIDS.
I watched the rest of those videos the other day, finally.
Yeah.
Some of them are not near as good as that one, but the Johnny Depp one's kind of funny. And the Steve Carell one's pretty funny, too. He's right in the middle of The Office.
Oh, my God. I can imagine.
Anyway. So let's talk about it. Let's talk about Insomnia. So this is a Christopher Nolan film. And prior to this, had you heard of it?
Yes. I've heard of it a lot, especially with the rise of Christopher Nolan, just critically. Surprisingly, Insomnia is one that's mentioned towards the tail end of some of his better movies.
Yeah.
Now,
do you think it's because it's underrated, or do you think it's because it's underseen? Or option number three, is it just not very good?
I just think it's not that good.
Okay.
Compared to what we get now from Christopher Nolan.
Yeah.
So
I am in the camp that this is an underseen movie. The Dark Knight is like a once in a lifetime film, right? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So to hold it up against that is different. Plus, and it is better than his first film. This is the second film. Better than his first film, Following, by all accounts. But, you know, this film, and I'll let you break down the synopsis for this, and then I'll break down the synopsis for the second one. But, just read it.
Sorry.
No, I'm saying that. I just said not like you don't have to give me like a play by play, just like the generals. But, this film is very different than a lot of Nolan's other films.
This is
a grounded, nose to the street kind of detective film.
I don't have any backstory on the making of this movie, but I was honestly, I was pretty surprised to see that Steven Soderbergh was one of the executive producers for this movie, along with George Clooney. And
yeah, it's a remake. This film's a remake of an original.
Yeah. When I was watching this, I felt the Soderbergh kind of imprint on some of the character types and the story. Like this movie would have been very similar, but taken, I think, in a different direction if like a Steven Soderbergh was directing this.
Yeah. So I know there's one small fun fact about this one. They didn't get to do any rehearsals with anybody together. So like the scenes with Robin Williams and Al Pacino, they got to see each other and stuff. They just didn't get to rehearse together. Like a lot of people get to rehearse together, do some mock scenes, stuff like that. None of that happened for this film.
Okay.
So like that scene on the boat or stuff like that, first time snapping character, that's the first time they're doing all that.
That's impressive.
So it makes it less impressive for Pacino, more impressive for Robin Williams because this film is coming off, this and the film 1 Hour Photo were filmed in the same year. So Robin Williams is starting to really kind of show off his
dramatic chops
that he had been challenged to do. I can't remember, someone challenged him to do it and he did. I'm not saying that's directly why he did it, but I know this came on the heels of that. And we are better for it, I think. Obviously,
yeah, absolutely.
But all right, so give me the brief rundown of the film.
So a tough cop,
Al Pacino, a brilliant
killer, and an unspeakable crime. Two Los Angeles homicide detectives are dispatched to a northern town where the sun doesn't set to investigate the methodical murder of a local teen. So this movie takes place in somewhere, I think it was called something Hunt. Well, some small town in Alaska.
Garrett's Hunt.
Garrett Hunt.
Garrett's Hunt.
I hate that.
All Garrett's Hunt.
Okay.
That's a Marshall County thing.
So, just a small town in Alaska. It's at the time of year where they have, I think, like 30-something days of daylight.
And then they'll have 30 days of darkness. There's a whole vampire movie based on 30 days of night.
Yeah.
For an alternate universe.
Most recent True Detective season based on you know, 30 days of night.
Which the whole 30 days of day, very interesting twist on that.
Yeah.
And really adds a lot of like a nice layer of subtext to like a nice subplot of this film. That really is an Achilles heel for Al Pacino as the lead detective in this case that comes in from the mainland because he's struggling with different things that are happening. He's got his own stuff going on with internal affairs and all sorts of stuff. He's also slowly losing his sanity because he's getting no sleep because of the sunlight outside. Yeah. So it's just a nice extra layer that Nolan put in there that I think you take that out, I probably wouldn't have liked it as much. It's just nice because he becomes more unhinged as it goes.
Yeah. And I think I don't think it was utilized enough or wasn't executed the right way.
You only really get that. The most impactful scene is when he's obviously barricading up and when the hotel lady comes in and he kind of confesses.
Yes, exactly. So. I think this was after Memento. So I think there was that expectation of what Nolan can do with kind of timelines and all that. So the first act of, I guess you could say, insomnia ridden actions is whenever they're chasing after this supposed suspect that they haven't really identified yet.
Yep.
And it pulls them into this into the woods, down this forest.
Dense fog.
Yeah, extremely dense fog. And Al Pacino's character spots a shadow. He thinks it's the guy because it's who he's been chasing. And basically just pulls his gun on him and shoots him down. Goes down and come to find out it is his partner who had before basically admitted that he was going to out him to the
internal affairs
for otherwise how he handles certain cases. And you come to find out later that he frames otherwise, you know, suspects that he thinks without a doubt did it that right. probably couldn't be proven. So he's framing people.
Kind of like Jamie Foxx in Law Abiding Citizen, but in a cop perspective.
I guess so, yeah.
Because I think he has a moral compass. I just think that sometimes he just does things to expedite the process.
Yeah. Well, it was the opposite, because all Jamie Foxx was interested was the completion, like the success rate.
As long as he had a perceived win, like he wouldn't just do everything immoral, as long as he could find a silver lining.
The due diligence of it all. So basically, Will Dormer, Al Pacino's character, is just this grizzled, like, get it done type of detective, no matter the cost. And he ends up shooting his partner, Hap, played by Martin Donovan, who is, you know, has been there the whole time, mm-hmm. you know, been there along the way with him, but is just kind of conceded the fact that I'm going to take the easy way out. Like, I see the exit and I'm going to take it now while I still can. And you know, Will Dormer, just doesn't really, he kind of calls him out on it. And whenever they're out on this chase, he accidentally shoots him, but Hap's character comes up to him, Hap is scared of him. He blames him, thinks he does it on purpose because I guess Will's displayed that he'd be willing to do anything to cover him. Mm-hmm. And so that guilt and everything, you know, it goes on to him basically framing, because he finds the gun of the suspected killer there.
Yeah.
And once he takes that gun, this felt like an Edgar Allan Poe story. Like, it was the Telltale Heart.
Not just in the story, but like the setting, everything felt it was like an Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah, because whenever it's only whenever he's in the room that he truly deals with the guilt and the you know, the guilt and the insanity of all the different kind of everything that's taking place. So yeah.
Oh, sorry, I'm still so get me to Robin Williams.
So once
because you've done a nice Al Pacino backdrop. Now give me the Pacino Williams.
I got you. Yeah. Okay. I gotcha. So after he's killed Hap, he has this gun, and it's now everybody has decided that the suspected killer was the one that killed Hap. Mm-hmm. And
he did a caliber switch.
Yeah, Al Pacino basically lets him believe it. But he gets a call, and it is Robin Williams' character, Walter Finch, who basically says, "I saw you do it. And if you want to basically, you know, not
to rat you out.
Yeah. If you don't want me to rat you out, we need to meet." And, basically we get some more backstory on his character. We find out that he's a writer, Finch is a writer, who does, basically detective stories.
And so successful one.
Yeah. Successful. Yeah. And he's playing into this whole, all of these events, he's kind of playing into his like potential like source material for his own stuff. And so how he talks to Will Dormer, it's
also like very, like the first time they meet each other, it's like very reserved, very cautious, very almost disabled in a way.
So whenever you're first introduced to Walter Finch, you're convinced that he's the one that did it.
Yeah,
there's no doubt that this is
they definitely paint Robin Williams as a bad guy out the gate.
Okay.
And they paint, it's because like Al Pacino's obviously has issues, and they paint Robin Williams out to be bad.
Yeah.
Although I thought I looked too deep into this kind of stuff. I thought Hilary Swank was a bad person in this film.
Oh no. Yeah.
For sure.
Hilary Swank. And again,
she's a local PD.
Soderbergh involvement is kind of like, because Hilary Swank's in a few other of hers. She is the like our avatar, like she's how we relate to this movie. Like she's the real detective in this whole thing, trying to find the truth behind it. She's the one that's picking up on, you know, the slug, you know, the caliber changes, mm-hmm. where the shot actually came from, and picks up on Dormer's internal affairs issue and is slowly putting the pieces together while in the meantime, Dormer and Finch are doing this cat and mouse, like chicken, like game of chicken of like who is going to show their hand first as far as like who did what.
Right.
Because they have this run in at the ferry where they decide that they're going to meet, which is what you mentioned earlier of this is like, I feel like where the most acting is happening is this kind of standoff of, kind of showing each other their cards.
Yeah. Like, and I thought Robin Williams was great in the post.
Yes. Scene. I was just disappointed that I felt like this was the only like true acting we got out of him.
Yeah. Well, I forgot how much of a non-lead role he has in this film. It's kind of very similar to Gerard Butler in Cop Shop.
Yeah.
This is definitely a Pacino-led film with co-starring Robin, actually really more co-starring Hilary Swank than Robin Williams. But
yeah.
What you do get of Robin Williams, which is weird to say about a film led by him or that he's in, he's definitely the looming presence throughout this whole film. Or at least the second half of the film. And it's a big presence and he does it well because the times you do get Williams on screen, it is in a quiet, menacing kind of way. Like he is very, you just don't trust him. He comes across as deceitful. He comes across as dangerous. And, you know, he did murder the girl. And he turns out because she made fun of him. So he'd been in a fit of passion or rage, however you want to call it. He murdered a girl.
Yeah.
But Pacino's no better because he murdered his partner, plus he has other stuff on his background. So you got these two, you know, fallen guys who are neither morally sound. And you have Hilary Swank who is putting it all together on both ends. So Pacino goes through great, great heights to plant evidence at Finch's apartment to get him involved. But Finch is a step ahead of him the whole way, gets him, replants the gun at the guy's place. I can't remember what his name was. The abusive boyfriend or whatever.
Randy.
Yeah. So he replants the evidence that Pacino put in there. And then he baits Pacino to come have another conversation with him, which he records it, the whole thing, and then plays it back to him. And then that's where the buck finally ends up stopping. He has a showdown with Pacino and Hilary Swank and ends up getting shot and dies.
Yeah.
And then at the end, you know, she asks Pacino, like, Hilary Swank's police officer, did you kill your partner? And he's like, I don't even know if I did it on purpose anymore or not.
Yeah.
Because he's so sleep deprived. Everything with Williams has rattled him. But she respects that. I mean, she's willing to throw that bullet away, the evidence, to let Pacino be clear of it forever. And he's like, no, please be better than I've been. And the movie kind of ends.
Yeah.
I've obviously, you know, to John Aiken, this 1-2 skip a few, that's where you are.
Yeah.
The only person who really got a full confession is that hotel lady. I can't remember her name.
Oh, Maura Tierney.
Yes.
Rachel Clement is the character's name. There was a point that she made whenever Pacino is basically having his, you know, his whole unraveling, where she basically says there's only two kinds of people that live here. There are those that are born here and there are those that move here to get away. And Pacino asks her, like, you know, which one were you? It's like, I wasn't born here.
Yep.
Finch mentions in the beginning, whenever we first introduced to him, is that he's empathizing with Dormer, basically like, yeah, I know what it's like, you know, it was like this when I first moved here. And this part of his character is something that I feel like potentially could have been there that could have elevated this movie of if Finch had passed that he ran away from, like, and he pulls all this inspiration for his books, for source material and stuff. Like, what if he is a serial killer and we didn't know it?
Where do you stand on that?
I mean, I think he could have been. Like,
he's so smart.
Yeah. My thing is, and this isn't like, I feel like this was opportunity missed, is that you set him up as this character that was constantly on the move and had killed all these people along the way to you know, come up with material for his books. And Dormer has this run in with him, and now he's caught, and, you know, it uncovers all this stuff. And it would honestly erase kind of the blemish that Dormer has had on his own career of basically setting all this stuff up. I think it would justify the ending, I think, a little bit more as far as like how it plays out.
Yeah, this was like Redemption Island for Pacino, and it ended up being a, you know, basically a trial of his demons and having to exorcise them, and he failed miserably along the way. And same thing for Williams too, in a lot of ways. I think if things could have gone different, I think they had enough of a relationship just from the moment they're on that boat that I think that Williams could have changed too, but you just don't end up getting that here. And to me, that's okay. So my biggest thing with Insomnia is that I think it's a well-written movie. I think it's directed well. I think it looks good. It just feels so minuscule in the world of Nolan. And that's not a fault of the film, because in 2002, you didn't have Nolan that you have mm-hmm. today. But, you know, there's just something about this film that makes me enjoy it, because it's so much, it breaks apart from the standard Christopher Nolan kind of film in a more obvious way. It's a grounded, nose to the ground, sniff them out detective film. Cat and Mouse with Pacino and Robin Williams and Hilary Swank. It's a fun cast who I think play off each other really well in the film too. So, you know, for me, Insomnia, the average rating is 3.5. I gave it 3.5. I could be talked down to a 3, definitely not up. Mm. I had a really, really fun time with this the second go around. And like I said, I don't think it's underrated. I think it's underseen. I think it's probably rated at the bottom, towards the bottom of his filmography. But to me, that's not a slight towards it. It's just when you have stuff like Inception and The Dark Knight and Dark Knight Rises and Batman Begins, blah, 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 the list goes on and on and on and on. It's hard to put this in that category because it's a totally different film, totally different era.
Yeah.
I think 22 years removed.
Totally. And I think there are plenty of people that, outside of the people that have watched his whole Batman adaptations, like there's a whole other separate sect of people. This feels like the best Nolan introduction for an average person.
Yeah.
It doesn't push boundaries. It doesn't like throw you completely off your rocker for twists and turns. I think it's just
I could have gone for a tad more twist and turn in the film.
And that's the point I make. Like give our villain like more of a dark side. It just sounds like he was, you know, an awkward dude that got embarrassed and had an anger issue.
Snap out. Yeah.
So,
was there dudes like that out there?
There are totally. But not without some yellow flags here and there.
Yeah. A lot of people just breeze on through those.
Yeah. So yeah, I enjoy this. This is still a 3-star movie for me, and I don't have to see this one again.
Yeah. Now that I've watched it twice, I could watch it maybe once every few years, but it's not like something I'm just going to seek out on a regular basis. So how much screen time do you think Williams had in this film as a whole?
Total probably 25 minutes.
Yeah. I tried to find out last night and I couldn't figure it out. Yeah. I'm going to say around 20 minutes as well.
I was watching this movie and I think I was, it hit me. I was like, we haven't even heard of him. We haven't been introduced. Yeah. Check the time. The moment he made the call, we hear his voice for the first time 45 minutes into it.
Yep. And it's not like he even tried to do anything that drastic with his voice, but just the way he portrayed it with his eyes.
Yeah.
Like the way something about Robin Williams in this film felt heavy in a dark way. Like he had, like to quote Dexter, he had a dark passenger with him. Everything about Robin Williams worked for me in this film. It's very different than what we normally get from Robin Williams, at least at this point in time it was. And I just had a really good time with it as a whole. So as far as Nolan goes, it's not his best work. It's just early work. It's different work. And I think it's definitely underseen if you're on the fence.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely think it's worth a watch. Like it's not like a slog to get through. Like you're not going to hate watch it.
No.
So.
Totally agree.
All right. Let's talk about What Dreams May Come, directed by Vincent Ward, who's directed a bunch of films I've never heard of.
Yeah, nothing.
Now, he wrote Alien 3.
That's
yeah,
an accomplishment.
That's something.
I don't think so. Yeah, there aren't many titles that jump off the page. Vigil is probably one of his more well-received, outside of what we're about to talk about, though. The Navigator, A Medieval Odyssey.
Yeah. I don't know that.
Yeah, that's really... I mean, this dude, I mean, did a lot of work in the 80s, early 90s.
Yeah. So. I agree. Or, yeah, obviously that's so. All right, so let me... this is a 1998 film directed by Vincent Ward, starring Robin Williams, Cuba Gooding Jr., Max von Sydow, and Jessica Brooks Grant. I'm going to read the synopsis real quick, then we'll jump into it. Afterlife, there is more. The end is just the beginning. Chris Nielsen dies to find himself in a heaven more amazing than he could have ever dreamed of. There is one thing missing, his wife. After he dies, his wife, Annie, killed herself and went to hell. Chris decides to risk eternity in Hades for the small chance that he will be able to bring her back to heaven.
That's a very straightforward.
It is, which is funny. It's very straightforward, but if anybody's reading that and never seen this film, was like, what?
That was me.
Yeah. So did you know anything about this before we did? Have we discussed this?
We didn't
all?
Talk about it. And honestly, I wanted to go into it pretty blank. So yeah, I was pleased with my experience.
Yeah. So this film, did you get who, what director did this remind you of?
Gilliam. Yeah.
My man.
Yeah.
Me too. This film, that's why I watched it twice. I watched it 3 or 4 nights ago and I was pretty tired, but I watched it all. I was like, this is a 4-star movie. This time it was 3.5 on me last time. But did I bump it up?
Yeah.
And I watched it the second time. I was like, I did. I really like this movie. And it very much reminds me of Terry Gilliam.
Yeah.
And actually, Parnassus is actually what it reminds me most of. The plot of Parnassus, the visuals of Parnassus, but better in 98.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. This movie's really weighty.
Yeah. Way heavier than you would think it is.
Yeah. There's some storyline issues for me. Issues aren't the right word. Like, it just, I don't know. It was a bug more than anything.
I was like, I don't remember there being a bug in this film.
No, it just, I don't know. There was a lot of time that passes, which I understand in the hindsight whenever you look at.
You don't know what time passes like in hell.
No. I'm talking, I'm saying like the first 25 minutes.
Where he's still in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, it's and I get why we do that because there's a lot of reflection that kind of fills the gaps. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I didn't even realize that he was supposed to be super young in the beginning. He looked super weird with the long hair. It was just a really weird thing. And so when you jump ahead to whenever they have grown kids and all that type of stuff, like I don't know. I enjoyed it, but I mean, I would prefer to hear more of your takes on this, honestly. Just kind of fill in the blanks.
Yeah, so this film really opens up and it follows Dr. Nielsen.
Yeah.
Which is Robin Williams' character, and he is increasingly frustrated that everybody's ignoring him. No one talks to him. Everybody seems to ignore, can't see him almost. Well, it turns to find out that when he sees his wife visiting his grave, that he's dead. And he realizes that he has passed and he can no longer communicate. And he lets go.
Yeah.
And passes on to heaven. His wife is a big painter. And the reason the wife is grieving and helps him realize that he's dead and grieving is because their kids had previously died in a car accident. Mm-hmm. And he died in a car accident.
Yeah.
So when he moves on and goes to heaven, he's in like a heaven of his wife's creation. She was a big painter. So heaven is watercolors and pastels and like creamy, thick, swirled, caked on paint.
Yeah.
And Cuba Gooding Jr. is like his spiritual Gabriel, who's guiding him and kind of filling him in on death and his life and his kids. And, but then he kind of informed him the worst thing scenario is like, hey man, your wife, she's in hell. So what? No. It's like, yeah, you kill yourself, you go to hell.
Yeah.
Which evangelicals around the world and charismatic like, hey man, you heard that right. which a lot of people had problems with this movie because of that. Whatever, you know, I don't really care what your theology is, because none of us really know.
Anyway, so he goes on this mission to go to hell to save his wife because there's a long, long ball chance that he can get her out of hell.
Yeah.
And he's willing to sacrifice himself to get her out of hell so she can go spend eternity with her kids, all or their kids together. So they hire a tracker, yeah. which is Max von Sydow, and he's going to take them from heaven into hell. So you leave this very scenic, like permanent sunset, watercolor pastels, beautiful Dalmatian dog, you know, and then you know, cherubim floating in the sky playing harps. It's mm-hmm. beautiful. And it was really beautiful scenery. Then you go into literally very dark, brooding, hellish Dante's, like seven realms of Dante's Inferno hell on this little boat. I mean, you got like the River of Styx, and it was a pretty dark depiction. You got all the, that little road with all the faces, like the, you know, coming up from the ground. It's a pretty harsh change. And then about this time, him and Cuba Gooding Jr. having a conversation, and Max von Sydow and him kind of sniff it out that that's his son in a different form, wanting to spend time with his dad. And once Robin Williams realizes that, they have a moment, hug it out, and then he sends his kid away because he don't want him getting stuck in hell.
Yeah.
So, you know, his kids are, he sought him out just in a different form. And
I got to say, I thought the daughter one was kind of creepy.
Why?
Because the daughter took the form of a girl that took the form of a woman that her dad thought was attractive, basically.
Yeah. And she said that.
Yeah.
She explained.
It was weird, though.
Yeah. The first time I saw it, I thought it. Second time I saw it, less. Third time, I didn't think anything of it.
Okay. It was just.
I think it's because this is, I think this movie is a rewatch movie.
Yeah.
Like, I think you should rewatch it at some point.
I would love to see this. I'll save this towards the end. I was wanting to save this towards the end, but I would love to see this in like a 4K remastered.
Mm-hmm. And it won't get that because nobody's seen this movie.
I don't know, man. It's the curve on this is
3.3.
Like, yeah. This is polarizing. I don't think it's the right word, but it surely people talk about this.
I don't think so. Very underseen on my friends list.
Yeah, same.
But so he finally gets to hell. It's in a dilapidated, her hell is like a very broken down, dilapidated version of their house.
Mm-hmm.
She's a shell of who she was. And, you know, there's a lot of illusion, a lot of conversation dancing around religious symbolism yeah. and souls and stuff like that. And he does convince her, you know, gets her out of her shell and, you know, takes her place that seemingly so. But what really happens is, you know, after all the sacrifice, he gets to basically choose, do you want to spend eternity here in heaven, you know, with your kids in paradise, or do you want to be reincarnated with your wife and start over? And he chooses to be reincarnated. So him and his wife reincarnate basically with the memories that they have now, but as young children meeting each other on like a playground one night. They're meeting each other somewhere as the young kids.
I don't remember.
The ending. I think it was like a playground or something. Anyway, so that's how they choose to.
Yeah.
He chooses to go back.
The house.
The house.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. so, you know, they're going to get to start their lives over again and do all that and have the same kids, yada, yada. I don't get lost into the how's that going to work.
They were going to have the same kids. No, the kids were going to stay.
In heaven, yeah.
Yeah. So it's not like
I just assumed that since they were starting over with the same memories, they'd still birth the same kids.
Mm-mm.
And I was about to literally say, but I'm not going to sit here and try to break down the...
Yeah.
Make my mental gymnastics work that way.
No, I think...
Well, that makes me feel better. It's just their... See, that seems kind of selfish then.
Yeah. This movie is very selfish.
Yeah. Which I get it. It'd be tough.
Jeff
Carroll will be like, it's the right thing to do because you love your spouse before your kids.
The topic of this, yeah. Yeah, you got to.
Yeah.
The topic of this movie is really hard, and I get it.
They don't do a great job with it.
There's no easy way. No. Well, I mean, they did 13 Reasons Why this, thankfully. Like, whenever they're set. So, before we got the news that she had passed, that she was going to kill herself,
in the film.
I wholeheartedly, like, thought, oh, this movie is going to lead us all the way to the end to where, you know, basically Robin Williams' character, his soulmate is still in a living world and he's losing connection with her. The only way that they can be connected if she's dead, and it's going to be this big glorification of suicide. And, you know, she was going to end up back with him and it was going to end happy somehow. Weird. And I just wasn't going to get down with that personally.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know.
To your surprise, that's not what happened.
That's not what happens. I think they do a decent enough job as far as kind of showing the gravity of this, of these choices.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just this movie does a great job representing grief.
Yeah.
When we get more
fantastic.
Yeah. When we get
the backdrops, the art backdrops of this film, like I said, this movie walks so Parnassus could run.
Yeah.
I mean, some people would say the argument that Parnassus walked.
Yeah. But Parnassus crawled.
Like, very similar kind of vibe though. Like really, you know, Johnny Depp, like I think of him doing the leapfrog so happy. And then his envy comes in, it's a black river. And now this, it goes through the very similar kind of layers of hell and all that kind of stuff. Very, very similar.
Yeah, this world feels way more fleshed out, though.
Oh, for sure.
It's funny because the real world, I feel like we spent very little time there.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was kind of, it helped kind of how this, you know, heaven, quote unquote, heaven was not predicted, depicted.
Yeah.
It just helped. I love the fact that it played on the wife's, Annie's artistic ability. Like it was his world, but through her vision because of the connection that they had. I don't know, man. It was a really touching movie.
Truly. Yeah, it really is. And Robin Williams is a phenomenal performance here.
Yes. Like, let's talk about the performance.
The way that Williams in this film, in the same way that I mentioned it in Insomnia, is Williams does so much with his eyes in these live action films and like his facial tics and stuff like that. And Insomnia is no exception. He was great in that film in that regard too. But doubly in this film, like it's like he was there. Like the way he just, you know, enveloped himself into the world, this heaven, the hell, the real world, and dedicated to the bit was really impressive to me in this, considering that, you know, the technology, I mean, he wasn't obviously in pastel-laden films and all this kind of stuff.
Like,
for such a beautiful world that he's in, he actually literally seemed to be in there enjoying it as we watch it on the screen. So he was great there, but he also conveyed the emotion. Like, when he confronts his wife, or actually early in the film, when he's a ghost in the real world and he leaves to go for the first time, that was pretty tough to watch.
Yeah.
And then, like, in the, at the end, or not the end, getting closer to the end, where he is, in hell,
mm-hmm.
with his kid,
yes.
or with his wife in the house, and that whole scene where he's trying to sacrifice himself to stay so she can live. You know, Williams is also a great performance there too. Like these performances to me aren't that far off from like a Good Will Hunting, Dead Poet Society. They're different because it's a different kind of film, different kind of tone. But to me, I think they're just as impactful and done to the same level as the other ones, as far as the director would write it, allow it to go.
Yeah.
I think Williams gives as good as, I think for what Williams was given, he gives the exact same in this film as he does Good Will Hunting and Dead Poets. And I can't, did you see your door shut?
It just sound like your house settling.
I feel like this film is probably one of his best performances of his whole filmography, just based on what I remember.
Oh wow.
Performance wise.
Yeah. I don't think I'd go that far, but I did think his performance was the most endearing that I remember.
Mm-hmm.
I think he has different emotional beats in other movies that I think kind of work better for me, but for what this movie hits on, I think he executes it perfect.
Yeah.
It
does a good job of, because Robin Williams is known for being the kids movie, fantastical.
This movie felt very childlike.
It did.
The
That's
entire
what I was about to
time.
Say. It blended those two things without sacrificing either.
Yes.
Yeah. Like to me, this is like a perfect role for Robin Williams.
Yeah. The thing that worked so well for this movie emotionally for me was that, it has this whimsical, fairy tale like tone about it. But obviously the issues, the realities of it are very heavy to whenever we're faced with them, whenever they're in her hell,
mm-hmm.
and we find out what the double D actually represents.
Yeah.
Like, we're thinking this whole time, they reference whenever they're still alive. Oh yeah, it's our fourth Double D anniversary.
Yeah.
We are led to believe it's the anniversary of both of their kids right. dead.
Yeah.
Which I'm thinking at the time, well, that's really freaking insensitive.
Yeah.
To call it Double D. And then we find out whenever we basically in the past she had been she had been put into basically an insane asylum, like some kind of mental institution, because she had a mental break. That Robin Williams, absolutely. Robin Williams had basically proposed an ultimatum, or not an ultimatum, like divorce.
Yeah,
it was like it was like, I realize that I have not been there for you, what haven't made you happy, whatever, and basically want to give you an out and all this stuff. And they choose each other. And so the concept of their Double D day, their anniversary, decision, that was a decision or divorce, something like that. She's like, oh, it's a Double D, something weird like that. When you find out that anniversary was their commitment to their own relationship, just goes to, you know, emphasize the point that your marriage, your relationship, like those choices that you make, mm-hmm. which is all this movie is about. It's about choice. You know, you know this, having a kid, like you love your child more than anything.
Yeah.
And you know, you do choose to love them, but there is a responsibility of love. But our spouses, our relationships, we choose.
Right.
We outright choose to love them.
Yeah.
And that has its own separate type of meaning. And I don't know, man. It was pretty impressive how this one kind of snuck up on me.
What was your favorite like visual of this film?
It probably is not my favorite, but the one that sticks out to me the most is whenever he's first introduced to the world.
Mm-hmm. With Cuba Gooding Jr.
Yeah. Yeah. When Cuba is like blurry,
mm-hmm.
And all that is just kind of being fleshed out, I think it's really effective. It was one of those things, like I couldn't tell if how I was watching it. It was just like too bad of like resolution, and it was pixelated. Mm-hmm. And then you find out, oh, this is like Van Gogh type of like artistry.
Yeah.
It was really cool. And you know, whenever the whole world is kind of rendered out, you know, it's fine. It was effective, but yeah, I kind of like the whole painting look of it all.
Yeah. Actually, the opening painting is still my favorite, although, you know, thick canvasy paintings, but also in terms of just jarring to the film is the Sea of the Damned faces.
Yeah.
When they're encountering the storms, and it's the Sea of the Damned, that was pretty intense and just a nice change up. So this is based on a book and a novel. There were some pretty significant changes. I read this last night.
I was just thinking while we were talking about this, I was like, I would be really interested to see how this is portrayed in a book because of, a lot of it just feels book-like.
In the film, there's a lot more references to New Age, paranormal beliefs, there's seances, astral projection, Wicca.
Yeah.
The director cut all that out. Didn't want to, probably because he didn't want to alienate too many people. If you all throw that on there, you're losing even more people.
I think if you hit your main points of heaven, hell, and then like your reincarnation, I think that's a pretty broad scope.
His kids didn't die in the movie, just him and his wife, and his kids are minor characters in the real world.
Okay.
Well,
I thought the kids dying was very effective. I'll say that.
Yep, same. Max von Sydow's character is not in it at all. There's no tracker, which I thought was a good plot point. And he's a Hollywood screenwriter
kid's doctor. Wait.
Yeah, so I agree. The afterlife imagery is based on natural scenery rather than paintings. So I like the paintings better.
Yeah.
The novel of hell is considerably more violent in the film. He can't barely move, breathe, or see, and he suffers intense physical torture at the hands of the inhabitants. There's no thunderstorms, no fire, no sea of human faces. him and Albert climb craggy cliffs and encounter such heights as swarms of insects that attack people. Hmm. Anne is in hell for 24 years, not eternity. And she escapes hell by being reincarnated because she's not ready for heaven. So that's the differences from the novel. So I like the film better.
Yeah. I mean, it feels like way more buttoned up.
Yes. And translated better to the screen, which to the point, this won an Oscar.
Yeah.
For best visual effects. It lost best art direction, but it won best visual effects. It also won the Screen Actors Guild Award for excellence in production design and the Satellite Award for best visual effects.
Well, I can see that.
Yep. So I get that too.
I will say, like, the difference in the book and movie, the book definitely feels more like an Odyssey type of story.
You gonna go read this now?
No, definitely not going to. But yeah, the movie, it is a true like romance movie, you know, mm-hmm. with family drama stuff to it. But yeah, it was a love story for sure.
It was the highest grossing film at the box office its opening weekend, second behind Ants.
Wow.
Ants.
Wow.
Yeah. So Roger Ebert gave it 3.5 out of 4 stars, though. It's pretty good for Roger and Ebert. What do you think of Cuba Gooding Jr.?
Good, honestly.
I liked the weirdness of the character a little bit, like the childlike part.
Yeah, yes, the childlikeness of it all, I think, in the beginning especially, played well with Robin Williams and what he does. So it worked pretty well.
I'm trying to see what year Radio came out. 2003, never mind. Because he gave very kind of, well, not similar vibes, because he obviously wasn't special needs.
But I mean, he always, I feel like he has those vibes a lot. Like, I don't know.
Apparently he was part of the Diddy stuff too, so. Well, I know he's in the lawsuit, but anyway. So what'd you end up rating What Dreams May Come? And do you have any other closing thoughts on it? Because we just kind of really buttoned that up.
Closing thoughts on it, and I mean, it ties into my ratings. I give this 3.5. And I think I wanted to give this 4. And I was kind of hoping that our talk would help sway me to a 4. But I think overall, there's not as much backstory that I would have wanted.
Mm-hmm. But better than the book.
Yeah, definitely. But I enjoyed it enough. I don't think I have to see this again, though.
You should watch it again. This could be Caitlin film.
No, it'd be too heavy for them. Yeah, it'd be too heavy for them. Yeah, I don't know. It was good. Maybe
Tideland a little bit.
Yeah, I'm not making them watch Tideland.
No, this is kind of like Tideland a little bit.
I understand
that. It's like Tideland. It's like the thematic weight of Tideland with the visuals of Parnassus.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is the most Gilliam film we've seen in a while.
Yeah.
I'm here for it.
But yeah, 3.5. And I think it'll stay there.
Yeah, it's a solid 3.5. Not got in danger of going to a 3?
No, definitely not. No. Visually enough, like it's going to stay there.
And
Robin Williams' performance, yes. And the supporting cast as well. I thought the kid actors were great. Yeah,
very rare, especially in the 90s. Or no, more. It was more popular in the 90s to have better kid acting. You forget that. I was going to say, kid actors today aren't near as good, seems like.
Well, yeah, but we know now why they're the way they were.
Yeah, yeah, they were abused to perform. So.
Yes.
Anyway. Yeah, What Dreams May Come for me is a 4-star film. For me, I had it at 3.5, and after I watched it my second time this week, I bumped it up to 3.5 because I just had a great time with it. Visually, it's stunning. Williams gives a great performance, and I'm a Terry Gilliam sucker. This definitely gave me heavy Terry Gilliam vibes, so I had a really good time with this, and it's been my favorite Robin Williams film of the bunch so far. So that's where I asked, let in. Is this
It definitely has been my favorite so far.
So going in, you haven't seen any of these 4 films. Correct?
No, I hadn't seen. No.
So are you for 4 films into Robin Williams' filmography, how are you with, do you have a bigger appreciation for him now after seeing 4 films that you haven't seen of his, or are you still about?
No, I just have more context to who he is as an actor. Yeah. I've always known that he has this ability because especially after he had passed, it was more celebrating his whole body of work type of thing.
Yeah.
And it's really sad. I mean, that was honestly, we didn't talk about it, but that was the saddest part about this movie.
Because he killed himself.
Yeah. Yeah. Just how his life ended.
Just wait till we watch World's Greatest Dad.
All right.
Just wait.
All right.
That movie is not going to hold up well in the light of everything.
Yeah. And so, I think overall, I have had more context to who he is as an actor. So, and I've appreciated it.
Yep. So, I'm a very big fan of this film. Very glad I watched it again. This is like one of those films I wish Criterion would do a release, a cut of.
Yeah.
I'd definitely be all over that. So next week we have Hook, which is a Steven Spielberg-led film starring obviously Robin Williams, Dustin Hoffman, Bob Hoskins, Julia Roberts, and some Dante Basco.
All right.
We're also pairing that with a Chris Columbus film, a film that I have not seen, Bicentennial Man, starring Robin Williams, M. Beth Davids, Sam Neill, and Oliver Platt. Pretty good cast there, too.
Mm-hmm.
I have no clue anything about this film, so.
Yeah, I don't think I know anything about these as well.
But you've seen Hook.
Yeah.
Okay. You said these, so I was a little nervous.
Oh, sorry. I was looking at the wrong list. Yeah,
Bicentennial Man and Hook are for this next week. So definitely a little bit of a change, dipping more into the, I don't know about Bicentennial Man, but Chris Columbus doesn't do edgy films, really. So I'm assuming this is more kid fantasy.
Yeah.
Sci-fi fantasy based. So a little different break. I'm excited to watch. So excited to watch Hook again, but excited to pair it with a movie I hadn't seen yet. So I'm very much liking this Robin Williams
good
session, because none of them really have felt too samey so far.
Yeah. And they're not, I mean, What Dreams May Come has been the heaviest, but not super heavy.
Yeah. Moscow and Hudson was the second heaviest.
Yeah. Tonally, I feel like a lot of these movies have been pretty lighthearted, which is, again, I think what we relate to Robin Williams. So yeah,
Insomnia wasn't overly lighthearted.
No, but considering
the F you care.
Okay, Al.
That was like the only like Al Pacino you got in that film. Yeah. Like he just randomly in that argument.
The Oscars Best Picture nom, whenever he did the reading for
this year.
Yeah, he's like, my eyes see Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
I guess I totally forgot that Al had the relationship with Christopher Nolan.
Yeah.
Which I feel like should have been the telltale sign that it was obviously, if it wasn't any beforehand, but that he would be presenting that. Because it wasn't it Harrison Ford that presented the year before for Everything Everywhere All at Once? It was Kiwi Kwan.
Yeah.
It's been good movies. Been really pleased with the old Robin Williams in review, and looking forward to all the other ones coming up. So
yeah, we'll have Dawson back on the show here in a few weeks. He wants he requested actually at dinner at Easter to come on and be a part of the week we do Jack and Cadillac Man.
Awesome.
He doesn't really care about Cadillac Man. He's just never seen Jack, but it's like one of his all time wants to watch. And now we'll have an excuse to do so.
Yeah.
So he's going to watch both and join us for both episodes here in a few weeks. So that'll be fun to have Dawson back on. Other than that, what are you going to do this week? You have anything you're going to watch this week?
Only thing I'm really looking forward to, Monkey Man comes out Friday.
Yeah, saw that.
We might have to see about going to see that possibly. I don't know what you got going on. But other than that, I'm looking forward to seeing Sugar, the Colin Farrell led kind of modern crime noir that's coming out. Ever since Perry Mason was taken off Max, I've got this like crime noir itch. I want itched. So I'm looking forward to it. What about you? Baldur's Gate.
Play a little bit more Baldur's Gate. Dragon's Dogma 2. Got to get into that too, but I got to finish the other first. I'm probably going to watch the American Society of Magical Negroes.
Yeah.
Snack Shack.
Snack Shack's been getting some great reviews. Yeah,
those are both ready to in the next day or so to be on, because they're
I truly
to stream.
I did not expect Snack Shack to get the praise that it's been getting, so I'll probably end up watching that one.
And I'll probably watch Please Don't Destroy. Dawson loved that film.
Yeah,
I might pair that with Snack Shack or something.
Really, Dawson liked that just because they're
SNL.
They got SNL.
Yeah, Imaginary's out there, and I keep thinking it's if
yes,
but it's not. It's the horror movie that we trailer roundup for, but
yeah, which I'm not going to be watching.
Yeah, the reviews aren't great, so probably won't either. But I'm definitely going to watch the American Negroes and Snapshot for sure this week. Awesome. And if I can get away, yeah, I'd like to go see the
Monkey Man.
There's something else that comes out this week too. Hang on, bear with me. Set a mark.
I mean, Kong and Godzilla. That was out this past week.
It's the first Omen. That's not what I was
not, wanting. Not interested.
I still want to see Immaculate. Oh, Late Night with the Devils at Cinemark.
Yeah, I'll probably wait to see that for at home.
Why? No, bro, we got to go see that. No. We got to go see that.
I'll talk with Caitlin. I'll probably have to go see that one, Caitlin. I mean, we'll see it together, but yeah.
Caitlin wants to see that?
I think so, yeah. She knows nothing about it, but if I told her it was scary, she'd be down for it.
I'm going to tell Abby we're going to go on a double date. I'm going to tell
her. You're not
going
to tell her it's scary? That's the worst idea.
I'm going to tell her, we're going to go see this reality talk show thing.
Listen.
Based on a true story, make it even worse.
Oh, God.
So, no, I'm just kidding. But anyway, yeah, well, let's aim to try to go see something. Then I'll talk to Tyler. Let's get a group together and go see Megapolis in Nashville.
Yeah, we should make it happen.
That'd be a fun time. Until then. Like us, love us, rate us. Mostly Focus gave us a few extra listens. Dawson's episode got like 20.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty good average for us now for Mostly Film.
Good deal.
Consistently per week. I'll take that.
See a lot of people going back and watching some old episodes, which is fine. But, you know, stay current with us.
Yeah.
Stay current.
Now, you could just go blitz them all.
Yeah. In the course of a week. This is like current events type stuff. So, you know, some of it might not be so relevant.
Although the older stuff, though, there are at least timestamps. I did timestamp them back then.
Yeah.
So you could skip through the trailer roundups and the news and just listen to what we've been watching, because that's always relevant, because that's just reviewing films in general. So anyway, yeah, maybe one day if I renovate my garage and get some furniture in there, we can film this too. Have some different movies in the background displayed for what we're in review for.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, yep, that's us for this week. We'll be back next week with Bicentennial Man and Hook and whatever we watched. I'm gonna watch The Seeding this week too.
All right, let me know how it goes.
So all right, we will see you all later. This has been Mostly Film, your one-stop chaotic shop for all things in the world of cinema. I'm one of your hosts, Sean the Recorder, to my beautiful co-host JP Payton.
See you guys.
Bye.